Is there a place in time where logic breaks down and wonderment begins? Could that be somewhere or sometime along an indefinable line between the reasonable and the highly unlikely? Makeshift Stories presents a monthly journey into the improbable.
Today's story, episode 231, The Fifth World, chapter 4. Read by Mitchell Two. Opening and closing theme by Matthew Erdman. Somewhere and sometime, intelligence might not be conscious. A memory is modified each time we access it, and therefore the accuracy of my account is limited by the ambiguity imposed in the act of recalling the incidents numerous times. Additionally, I acknowledge the unusually long interval between the occurrences of events and their documentation here. With those caveats, I present to you my recollections of occurrences during the third week on the Fifth World. I found myself drifting at an undefined point in time between what had just been and what was about to happen. Fuzzy green and purple afterimages overloaded my optic nerves, preventing me from moving forward in the world which had grudgingly accepted my uncontrolled fiery descent from the vacuum beyond. My auditory senses rang with the remnant waves of an event so violent the atmosphere had been literally split apart to make way. Within microseconds, the void it left had collapsed in on itself, creating an eardrum-shattering tsunami. It may have been only a fraction of a second, or an entire lifetime I spent suspended between one moment and the next, but in that interval, I became aware of the machine which had delivered me to this place. Being an artificial construct, it was designated as a function rather than given a name. It was Ship. Ship had grown my consciousness from the interstellar medium according to the plan it carried across the unfathomable distance of the void. It had grown a physical presence for both of us so we could undertake our mission on this world. In service to that end, Ship had sacrificed its body in a catastrophic attempt to get me to the surface. But what was the mission? When did I lose that critical bit of information? Ship would know, but it had been forced to retreat to a kernel embedded in a small metal container. A container which, in the moment between time, appeared to be vanishing into the ether. Ship! I could sense its artificial presence reaching out, desperately looking for a new structure to latch onto before it and the container were obliterated. It grasped at me, but the distance was too great. Suddenly, it snapped back like an iron pellet drawn to a magnet to the point where Opportarius and the tractor had been. I could feel it attempt to merge and become something new, which radiated intense surprise and fear. But before I could make sense of what had happened, the abrupt and violent departure of the lightning started time moving again, and dazed, I rudely fell back into the world. In a dislocated fog, I carefully extracted myself from the mud, checking to make sure I hadn't broken or sprained anything when I had been thrown from the tractor. The rain was still coming down in torrents, which made it difficult to see very far. I slowly made my way toward Opportarius, along the last row of Krava, careful not to slip on the slick mud into the raging mountain stream which had replaced the crude road. It took a few minutes to get to the tractor, which had been spun sideways, partially blocking the angry runoff like a large rock dropped into the center of a fast-flowing river. The place where the driver sat had been scorched by lightning. I couldn't see Opportarius until I noticed where several Krava plants had been crushed by something. I frantically ripped away at the tangle of broken branches until I could see bits of mud spattered yellow at the bottom of a person-sized crater. At first, I thought Opportarius had been killed, until I heard a moan and saw movement. Carefully, I helped him sit up. He shook his head and looked at his hands as if he had never seen them before, then turned to me and tried to focus on my face, glassy-eyed. "I threw that metal thing of yours away just as the lightning struck and jumped. Otherwise, I'd be dead." He nodded at the charred tractor seat. "There was a moment before I hit the ground that I felt like something else. I could see stars and planets and I don't know, other things I can't explain. I felt like a veil had been lifted and all the mysteries were gone. For a brief moment, it felt that you and I had been together for eternity." He looked at me, searching for an explanation. "Then it was gone, and the next thing I remember is you helping me up." He started to pull himself to his feet. "I'm part of him," Ship implanted the understanding in my mind. I tried to hide my surprise and avoided looking directly at Opportarius, who seemed unaware of Ship's presence. As we huddled in silence under the Krava, waiting for the rain to subside and the muddy rapids to turn back into something passable on foot, Ship explained what had happened. The electrical energy building in the storm had awoken some deep-rooted instinctual response in the artificial mind, which automatically sent out tendrils to attract the power it needed to reboot. However, the lightning was magnitudes more than it had expected. In the instant of the strike, Ship's higher functions restarted, and in the millisecond before its container was vaporized, it jumped to the only available storage medium close at hand, the unused junk DNA in Opportarius's body. My colleague was unaware of this, and Ship had kept itself out of the Rodentian's conscious mind. It was a temporary solution, at best, and we would need to find a more appropriate vessel. But I did not know enough about this world to understand if that was even possible. The storm finally passed as abruptly as it had come, and by the time the raging waters had turned back into a rutted, two-track trail, we could hear the roar of one of the farm's big sprayers making its way toward us. Painted green and suspended above the crops on four giant skinny wheels, it looked like a predatory insect searching for its quarry. Although fully autonomous, this one was being driven by one of Colrin's mechanics. The big machine straddling the swampy trail rolled to a slow stop in front of the wrecked tractor, and the door to its bulbous domed cab swung open.
"Stop hiding and get out here, you lazy Agricolas!"
a big Rodentian wearing a bright yellow and orange vest yelled. We slowly extracted ourselves from the mud and stumbled out of the Krava.
"How'd you manage to do that?"
the mechanic pointed angrily at the tractor.
"It'll take days to fix."
"It was hit," I began to explain before Opportarius, who seemed to have fully recovered, elbowed me to shut up.
"Caught fire, boss,"
Opportarius offered apologetically and shrugged.
"Don't know how." "Agricolas, you're all useless. You break everything you touch,"
the mechanic complained.
"I've warned Colrin before that you lot are more trouble than you're worth. Maybe this time he'll listen."
He looked over at the wrecked tractor again and shook his head in disgust.
"If it was up to me, I'd just leave you here. But Colrin sent me out here because your tracker's malfunctioned. Guess he thinks he's got too much money invested in you. Trying to skip out on your work bonds, weren't you? What'd you do, take your shovels to the ankle vans? Stupid Agricola. You only knock out the long-range transmitter. The short-range ones are hardened against almost everything."
"We didn't touch them," Opportarius explained. "Maybe some water got in."
"I very much doubt that. Here."
The gruff mechanic threw a chain down, then climbed back into the cab and slammed the door shut. We picked it up and hooked the tractor to the big sprayer, then climbed up onto the ruined machine. "He didn't want to know what really happened?" I questioned once we were moving. Opportarius ignored me and kept his hands on the charred steering controls to prevent us from hitting the back of the big sprayer or weaving off into the crops as the big machine towed us back. He's confused, Ship placed the unspoken words in my head. And surprised you're stupid enough to even ask that question. Why? I channeled back. Because you should already know. Know what? Know to wait to be told what happened before you speak, Ship responded. Opportarius grimaced and clutched his forehead with one hand. Ship immediately stopped communicating. He glanced at me with a pained expression. My brain feels scrambled, he complained, and massaged his forehead. You were hit by lightning. Opportarius shook his head. No, I don't know what happened, and neither do you. But you don't know what happened, he warned. Is it so different where you come from? Don't be an idiot. No one's interested in what you saw, only what you are supposed to see. The next day, I watched a sickly brown stain on the horizon grow, which marked the location of the city where we were headed. We were clinging to the back of the old flatbed truck on our way to have our ankle bands fixed. Colrin had added an extra 2 months to our work bonds to cover the cost. Every time I tried to insist the bands had been damaged by the storm, Opportarius had cut me off. Now, he was sitting beside me in a sullen, uncommunicative mood, mindlessly watching the fields roll past, many still flooded from yesterday's violent downpour. Ship was also quiet. After merging with the Rodentian, it was only active when Opportarius was asleep, as it was easier for the artificial intelligence to communicate without being noticed. So my night had been full of interruptions, which, for the most part, were arcane descriptions of what it was doing to assemble in a way which would allow Opportarius and it to coexist. While important, this was of little use in determining what our purpose here was and how we should go about achieving it. Many buildings on the outskirts of the city lay abandoned in lakes of dirty, debris-filled water. Like flocks of nervous geese, plastic bottles pushed by the wind bobbed around the temporary ponds. Although most of the streets were passable, it was evident from the mud and garbage which threaded around parked vehicles, posts, and anything else standing in its way that they had recently been rivers of convenience for the deluge to rush to the sea. To me, it was obvious the city had experienced the same catastrophic weather event we had been caught in the day before, but everyone we passed seemed resigned to the cleanup, as if the skies opening up and drowning the streets was a phenomena of little consequence. The big flatbed jerked to a stop in front of a cinder block building on a crowded, narrow side street, which had mostly escaped the flood. The structure looked like any of the thousands of other three-story concrete block buildings we had passed on our way. They were in the process of being built or disassembled. We couldn't tell which. However, this one was covered with brightly colored signs and banners, which I couldn't yet read. The truck's driver rolled down the back window of the cab and yelled at us to get off and go inside.
The short-range transmitters still work, and the city is covered by a mesh network, so don't go thinking you can sneak off, he cautioned. The tech inside is expecting you. If she finishes early, just wait here until I get back.
Doing as we were told, we jumped off and watched the truck jerk back into motion, splashing muddy water onto the buildings and street merchants as it trundled away as fast as the potholed lane would allow, leaving a cloud of black exhaust and angry vendors in its wake. Despite the storm, the city was already too hot and well into cooking the garbage washed up along the curbs by the previous day's downpour. The smell almost made me gag. We turned to face the building with its confusion of competing banners and signs. Opportarius scanned them until he found what he was looking for, then motioned for me to follow as he went through one of the doors leading to a roofless stairwell. I was sweating profusely by the time we climbed up to a third-floor shop sporting a red electric sign. Inside, we were greeted by the rattle of a semi-dysfunctional fan and the greenish light of fluorescent tubes mounted haphazardly to the ceiling. The almost overwhelming smell of solder mixed by the fan with the ozone of burnt-out circuitry lingered in the space. Ancient wires wrapped in decaying black electrical tape led from the fan and lights to an outlet on one wall where other wires snaked away in desultory braids to power other bits of gear. Above the tangle of wires, a large flat-screen display had been bolted to the cinder block and was tuned to some kind of entertainment show. Ship and I had viewed many of these before we descended to learn the languages spoken.
"Sit on one of the examination benches over there by the wall,"
a scratchy voice directed from behind a counter with a wire mesh screen which extended from its surface up to the ceiling.
"And don't touch anything," it warned. "I've got security cameras in case any of your agricolon fingers take a liking to something that's not yours."
We sat on two well-used benches near the wall opposite the flat screen. Each sported a metal cuff similar to the ones around our ankles, attached to one of its legs by a short length of stout chain. The benches were, in turn, bolted to the floor. After a few minutes, it became obvious the proprietor had decided whatever they were working on was more important and more profitable than fixing two workers' ankle trackers. I could feel Ship begin exploring the possibilities of the crude electronics which, in various degrees of disassembly, littered the shop. Opportarius mindlessly watched the large screen, seemingly oblivious to the artificial's presence. The image on the flat screen suddenly changed to a tightly framed, older, surly Rodentian in formal dress with an emblem behind them, staring out at an unseen audience. The tech looked up from her work and touched a control to bring up the sound.
"I assure you, we are doing everything we can to assist in the wake of yesterday's flash floods."
The authoritative male voice was tinged with well-practiced indignation.
"In these trying times, we need to steer the course and not waver in our resolve. We will recover. We will prevail."
There was a pause while the speaker appeared to check something off screen.
"We have just confirmed the flood was once again caused by a massive release of water from reservoirs high in the mountains on the Ratufan side of the border. This is in flagrant contravention of international agreements, and I can assure you we have had enough. We have run out of patience, and we will respond in kind."
"But it was a storm," I blurted out in surprise.
"Shh," Arbitarius kicked my leg and whispered. "Quiet, you'll get us in trouble. They said it was the Ratufa again, so that's what happened. There was no storm."
"But we were almost drowned in it, and you were hit by lightning."
"No, that's not what I remember. We were in the field and caught in a flash flood. It was water released by the Ratufa."
"No," I protested. "There was lightning and a storm."
"What's all the fuss about?" the tech questioned angrily. "You made me miss the last part of the announcement. Storm? What storm are you talking about?"
She put her tools down and stumped out from behind the counter.
"Time to deal with you so I can get the scum out of my shop and go back to work without interruptions. Stick out your legs. Let me see those bands," she demanded.
We obliged. The tech ran a handheld scanner over each of them and frowned.
The circuits are burnt out like someone plugged them into a power outlet."
She gave both of us an accusatory stare. "We were almost hit by lightning during that storm yesterday," I tried to explain. She gave me a funny look.
"You're lying. There wasn't a storm yesterday. You and him wired something up to burn these out, didn't you? I could turn you in for that."
"No, I'm telling the truth. It was the storm. Why is everyone claiming it didn't happen?"
"We were fluffing off near a power transformer," Opportarius intervened. "He doesn't want our boss to find out, and neither do I. That's why he's made up the story about the storm." At first, the tech looked unconvinced, then ran the scanner over our ankle bands again.
"Okay, that might have caused this, but you'll need to take them off. You'll have to wear those until I have these fixed.
She nodded at the ankle bands chained to the benches.
Be right back. I'll just need to fetch the keys.
The tech seemed to take too long fumbling around behind the counter where we couldn't see what she was doing. She's called the authorities and is stalling for time. Surprised, I looked at Opportarius, who was staring at the floor. It was Ship, I realized. The words were in my head.
She thinks you're lying. We've got to go. If they start looking into your past, they'll find nothing,
I added. Opportarius glared at me. Had I said that out loud? Quietly, I got to my feet and motioned for Opportarius to do the same. At first, he refused. Then, in lurching, barely controlled movements, he spasmed to his feet, bewilderment and terror flashing across his face.
That was me. I've had to take over. He refused to move,
Ship informed me. The tech turned around.
Hey, I didn't say you could get up,
she shouted angrily. Outside, heavy footsteps began scrambling up the stairs.
They're on the third floor, someone yelled.
Makeshift Stories is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. To get other great APN podcasts, head over to albertapodcastnetwork.com, where you'll find Press Start to Join, and join hosts Josh and Alan as they discuss video games, movies, TV, comics, Star Wars, and more. This episode of Makeshift Stories is also brought to you by PodPower. With PodPower, our sponsors are making it possible for us to amplify the voices of Albertans and Alberta podcasters. In this episode, Edmonton Community Foundation is helping us give a PodPower shout-out to Book Women. Book Women is a podcast about editing, publishing, and writing Indigenous stories. Three Métis librarians representing nations from across the homeland aim to inspire Indigenous peoples to share their stories in whatever form that they enjoy. Guests include Indigenous storytellers from diverse mediums like podcasting, burlesque, books, comics, social media, films, music, and everything in between. You can listen and find out more at bookwomenpodcast.ca.
This episode of Makeshift Stories is also brought to you by the Edmonton Community Foundation. Give, grow, transform. The Edmonton Community Foundation acts as a bridge between donors and charities to create a strong and vibrant Edmonton community. With the foundation's help, donors are able to make the best decision for their funds, and charities are able to fund their latest projects. You can get involved and start an endowment fund yourself or with a group. And once it reaches $10,000, it can start distributing funds. To measure how well the community is doing, the Edmonton Community Foundation, in partnership with Edmonton Social Planning Council, publishes an annual checkup called Vital Signs. You can read it and learn more at ecfoundation.org.
Makeshift Stories is released around the beginning and middle of the month. This month's story was written by Alan V. Hare and read by Mitchell Too. Opening and closing themes were composed and recorded by Matthew Erdman. Post-production by Matthew Erdman. If you'd like to connect with us, please send an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. Links to both are in the show notes. You can help us out by getting your friends to subscribe or follow wherever they listen to audio. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution No Derivative License, which means you are free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us, and don't alter anything.